Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and I am joined now by longtime public radio producer Larry Josephson. To coincide with the Jewish High Holy Days, his six-part documentary series, Only in America, is airing all this week on WNYC, 2 o'clock every day this week on AM 820. It's on the 350-year history of Jews in the United States, and we will talk mostly about a few issues that it raises and play some historic sound clips, including Lindbergh, Jolson, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And hi, Larry. Welcome back to WNYC.
It's a great pleasure, Brian. You're one of the very best of us who do this kind of talk radio.
You're very kind. Now, let's go back to the period just before World War II. Here is a clip from your series of a German-American speaking at Madison Square Garden against entering the war. Does this need any more setup?
No, I think it's strong enough.
And this is on George Washington's birthday, 1939.
It should be the duty of every citizen to demand of the sponsors of the large programs to stop feeding the public the trash of the Winchells, the Cantors, the Burns and Bernsteins.
In February 1939, 19,000 people gathered in Madison Square Garden for a rally in honor of George Washington's birthday, organized by the German-American Bund, a pro-Nazi organization.
And give the American public for a change a voice which really speaks the American language without a Jewish accent.
That's pretty chilling.
Yeah, and another part of that speech, he says that if George Washington were alive today, he would admire Adolf Hitler, as he did Bismarck.
We've got 12 seconds of Lindbergh here. You want to set this up?
Yeah, Lindbergh was head of the America First movement to keep the United States out of the European war. It was very strong. Some 80% of Americans agreed at that time. And he went around the country making speeches, and he identified Jews as one of the groups pushing us into the war.
If any of these groups, the British, the Jewish, or the administration, stops agitating for war, I believe there will be little danger of our involvement.
Actually, Lindbergh lost his admiration that came in originally from his flight across the Atlantic, because he wasn't per se anti-Semitic, but he identified Jews as separate from Americans, and he basically lost all his support. He was a goner.
So there was enough revulsion by anti-Semitism that it blew back on Lindbergh rather than on the Jews.
Yeah, that's right. And you know Philip Roth's relatively new book where he posits that Lindbergh becomes president, which I think is highly unlikely. The anti-Semitism runs as a current under all of American Jewish history. When they first got here in 1654, Peter Stuyvesant tried to get rid of them and called them this accursed race, these blasphemers of the name of Christ. And his bosses, the Dutch West India Company, said no, he couldn't get rid of them. And it's every period of American history has had some amount of anti-Semitism. General Grant issued an order during the Civil War banning Jews from the area of his command because of alleged trading with the enemy, which wasn't true. But it really peaked from the middle 20s to the end of, well, really to the beginning of World War II. And the thing, there was also this infamous Father Coughlin, who was on the CBS radio network owned by
that?
William Paley, and who just... he was right out there. I mean, there was no subtlety about it. And it was this all over the world, all over the Western world, anti-Semitism peaked hugely. And the restrictive laws that Congress passed in 1924 kept a lot of Jewish refugees from Hitler from getting into this country.
Those were the restrictive immigration laws at the end of the Ellis Island era.
That's right.
Why then? I mean, there's certainly been anti-Semitism in Europe for centuries. Why would anti-Semitism have peaked in the United States at that time? I guess it was right after the big wave of Jewish immigration to New York, the Ellis Island period, I guess roughly 1880s to 1920s, but they were almost all living in New York.
Right. Well, there were still a lot left in Europe who were murdered by the Nazis, but I think it has to do with the Depression.
I mean those who were in America.
Right. It has to do with the Depression. The Depression was terrible. And Jews have been the scapegoat from everything from the Black Plague to every kind of catastrophe in the diaspora. That was one. And they were seen all through. I think one of the root causes of anti-Semitism is the Jews refused to convert, to conform to the mores of the dominant group, and they kept themselves together. That's one of them. And then part of it is just, as Elie Wiesel told me, it's irrational. We apparently, every human being needs a scapegoat, except for you. You know,
you can be my scapegoat. Here's a really interesting clip from your series from around the same time, but the context of this is very different. It's Al Jolson singing in and talking about the jazz singer. Does this need any setup?
No.
What interested me was the ancient religious sense of God and music and prayer and emotional melancholy that represented the Jew in the synagogue, and how it was in the young fellow, but conditioned by America, how it broke out in jazz.
I never saw the sun shining so bright, never saw things going so right, noticing the day hurrying by, when you're in love, oh, don't it fly?
To me, it was always a play about the older generation and the young, radical, broken away from faith, from church, from synagogue, American generation, the baseball playing, the street boy, the pool room boy. The whole atmosphere was changing. So I felt it was a universal theme and that people would respond that way.
Al Jolson. Al Jolson
actually,
was Jewish?
Not Jolson. Oh. It was Samson Raphaelson.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's okay. I don't think Jolie would mind. It's Samson Raphaelson who wrote the play on which the screenplay of The Jazz Singer was based. And Jolson, his real name was Asa Jolson. And that story of, you know, his father, who was a cantor, wanted him to be a cantor, he wanted to be a jazz singer, is actually a paradigm for the Hollywood moguls. And they identified with this story. And it's one of the main sources of conflict on the Lower East Side was intergenerational. The parents wanted the kids to keep the old religion and the mores of the old country, and the kids wanted to be American.
Or communist.
Well, that's true.
at that time. But where does race come into it? Because we think of the jazz singer primarily as, you know, Jolson, this white guy doing blackface,
right,
which is offensive to African-Americans looking back on it.
Right. But it was, there is a danger in judging the past by today's mores. And so I'm not excusing it, but a lot of comedians and singers put on blackface at the time. And yes, it was demeaning to African Americans, but they didn't have the power to object. It was very popular. In fact, there were minstrel shows in which everyone was in blackface, and they were called coon shows. You can believe that.
Well, I believe it. And, you know, we see at least how much caution about the language has progressed, if nothing else, based on that and based on the clips pre-World War II that we heard earlier.
Yeah, I mean, the Bund had a rally in Madison Square Garden, which actually was, there were a lot of Jews who came to object, and actually some of them tried to stop it from the audience. It was led by Jabotinsky. It wasn't entirely one-sided. And Roosevelt, who supposedly was a friend of the Jews, actually it's been charged that he did very little to help European Jews. And there's this infamous case of the St. Louis, the ship that had 960-some German Jewish refugees. They were, through a long, complicated process, refused admittance to Cuba because they didn't have the money to pay bribes. They came to New York Harbor. Roosevelt wouldn't let them in. And we have a clip from an oral history of Sam Rosenman, who was his top political advisor, saying that if Roosevelt had let them in, he would have lost the 1940 election. Hmm. Well, maybe that's true or not. But the fact is that's a measure of the amount of anti-Semitism that was abroad in this country at that time.
Public radio producer Larry Josephson, my guest on WNYC, talking about his 6-part documentary series, Only in America, about the history of Jews in the United States. It's airing at 2 o'clock every day this week on AM 820 WNYC. You interviewed the 9th Jewish Supreme Court Justice of the United States, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and you brought a clip. Want to set this one up?
Right. It was one of the great thrills of my life to go to the Supreme Court and interview Justice Ginsburg. It is a place, I don't know if you've ever been there, but it's a place just is awesome, with pictures of all the old justices and everything. It's just a very quiet, dignified place. And she gave me an hour and a half. In fact, I kind of, my energy was flagging towards the end of it. And she's a very deliberate speaker. She takes 15 seconds to consider every answer, unlike someone like Justice Thurgood Marshall. But my primary interest was her as a woman, a Jew, and a judge, not her legal philosophy. And she told me an amazing story.
And I recall once we were coming back from some weekend vacation. We were driving through Pennsylvania, and there was what we would today call a bed and breakfast, with a sign outside that said, "No dogs or Jews allowed." I'd never seen anything like that before.
How did you feel when you saw that?
I felt upset because I was very proud of being born and bred in the USA, and that there were people who so hated Jews that they would do something like that, particularly at a time when the United States was aware of the Holocaust.
Sorry, what year was that she was referring to?
I'd have to backdate that. If they were aware of the Holocaust, it must have been in the late 30s or early 40s. But she, when she graduated from Columbia Law in 1959...
Maybe after the war.
Yeah, you're right. That's right, because she is in her 70s now. So you're right. Anyway, when she graduated from Columbia Law in 59, top of her class, law review, and she was law review at Harvard. Before that, she couldn't get a job. Nobody, no law firm, even the Jewish law firms, would give her a job because she was a woman. And women had not become associates in law firm. And she finally got a job with a federal judge through one of her professors. But it was a long, long path fighting anti-Semitism, sexism to get to the Supreme Court.
One thing, and it's a big thought to put in our last minute, but with the tiny, 2% of America population being Jewish, there have now been 9 Jewish Supreme Court justices.
And 2 at the moment.
Certainly anti-Semitism exists today, but we are in what many believe to be the golden age for Jews of all time anywhere today in the United States. Do you explore that question in the series?
Absolutely. We bookend the program with Peter Stuyvesant's anti-Semitic rants, and at the very end, we have clips from Joe Lieberman accepting the nomination as the first Jewish vice presidential candidate. And that's kind of like, and that not only on the Supreme Court, the Jews in every level of government, every level of politics, medicine, academe, and so forth, and they were all barred by quotas before that.
Is a history of Judaism of Jews in America synonymous with a history of anti-Semitism in America?
No. There are many golden periods within this. In fact, I was told by a rabbi once that it's a mistake to follow the lachrymose theory of Jewish history. It's not all been disasters and persecutions. It's been a great success story. And the reason, if I may, just for a second, the Constitution, the freedom of religion, no established religion, economic opportunities, and because they were white.
Larry Josephson, public radio producer. His documentary series, Only in America, airs all this week at 2 on AM 820. Always a pleasure.
Thank you. And you can also get it on onlyinamerica.info podcast.
The executive producer of The Brian Lehrer Show is Nuala McGovern. Our producers today, Jim Colgan, Priya George, Alan Smith, and Spencer Wilking. Our hardworking intern, Tomek Gross. That's Debbie Daughtry at the audio controls. I'm Brian Lehrer.